It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The United States and Israel are still at war with Iran after the two countries launched attacks over the weekend.
And yesterday, the Trump administration briefed Congress on the state of the war in Iran and what the plan is moving forward. President Trump has said U.S. military operations could continue for at least another 4 or 5 weeks. And Secretary of State Marco Rubio said Monday, quote, the next phase will be even more punishing on Iran than it is right now.
But some members of Congress are saying the president acted outside the scope of his authority by launching a war without congressional approval.
Votes are expected over the next couple days invoking the War Powers Act, which limits presidential authority to take military action.
We've been reaching out to members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation. We'll hear now from Representative Mark Pocan, a Democrat representing Madison and South Central Wisconsin. I talked with him earlier this morning.
Do you think that the U.S. and Israeli attack in Iran is justified?
Well, I went to a classified briefing yesterday, and after about an hour and 15 minutes, we still were not given anything that would be an adequate justification, an adequate description of what the mission is. And we certainly don't have any more insight than I think the average person does, because I don't think the administration has any more insight than the average person does on what's happening.
What questions do you still want the administration to answer?
Why? You know, when they were asked point blank, and, you know, this is all in public record stuff as well, so it's not anything from a classified setting, but when they're asked why was there a credible threat, because that would be the only reason the president could do something rather than going to Congress first as required by the Constitution and law, the answer was, you know, they thought they would respond to an attack. Well, response to an attack is not an attack to us. And the justification is weak at best. And then we asked, you know, things like, you know, there's a lot of American citizens abroad that are at risk right now. What kind of planning was done prior to this? They didn't even answer the question. You know, some Republicans are claiming that we don't need a war powers resolution because this isn't a war, yet they explicitly referred to it as war in the briefing. Look, they're all over the place, just like the president's comments have been on this. And, you know, what we don't need is the Keystone Cops running this. And right now, that's what it appears is happening.
Yesterday, we talked with Iranian-American Sona Kazemi of La Crosse about the war and its impacts on her community. She said she and her family are, for the most part, happy with U.S. intervention in Iran. Here's a listen.
See how desperate Iranian people should become in the hands of this illegitimate, murderous, fascist regime, that they come to a point where they say, you know, we need outside help to topple this regime and free ourselves.
In the justifications offered by the Trump administration, regime changes come up and then been kind of dialed back. But could there be a positive outcome? The people of Iran who have suffered under this regime for a long time could ultimately benefit.
You know, it's clear people were suffering in Iran, like in many other countries across the world with the leaders who are in charge. But, you know, that when we asked what's the plan, what are the next steps, again, there were no answers from the administration because I don't think they have a clue what they actually got themselves into. So, you know, unfortunately, this is kind of the worst of what we see where, you know, an executive branch, someone, one person, Donald Trump does this. Our founders of this nation purposely gave the power to Congress for this reason. So you wouldn't just step into something because one person decided to. And now we'll have a war powers resolution in front of Congress on Thursday that I'm going to support. But it's very clear Congress has to declare war. This is in every way a war. They have not given us any justification. They have not given us a mission goal at the end. What does it look like in Iran? And, you know, while I understand that, you know, caller, that person you had on the radio's response from their family response in Iran, because we've heard that from obviously other people, unfortunately, the administration, I don't think, has a clue what they're doing in Iran.
The War Powers Resolution you just mentioned, if passed by Congress, still an open question, what would that do? What would the effect be?
Well, it basically puts us in where we're supposed to, which is if there's going to be a war declared, then Congress would have to do such a thing. And, you know, we would be involved as required by law. Right now, we're not. I mean, you know, the fact that they were going to give us an hour briefing on this, that's it, 1 hour briefing, and we squeezed an extra 10 to 15 minutes out of them. You know, that's not advice and consent with Congress on something as big as this and as important as this. Six, at least, American soldiers have died. We're worried about thousands potentially of people abroad, American citizens. And again, I don't think the answers have been anywhere close to sufficient. So Congress has to do what the law says, and that's get involved. And if we choose not to because people don't want to upset the president, unfortunately, I think we put even more people at risk.
Your party is in the minority in both chambers of Congress, so Republicans would have to vote, at least some, in favor of the War Powers Resolution. Some Democrats, it's not a sure thing that they would vote on your side on this. What are you hearing from your Republican colleagues in particular?
Yeah, I mean, you know, from listening to questions, I mean, largely they're, you know, they're much more supportive in general when we go to war on anything. And, you know, I think you're going to see most Republicans oppose the war resolution because either they support the effort or they just are afraid of the president. Only a few have spoken out, but a few more asked some pretty pointed questions that, again, the administration didn't have answers for. We'll see what happens with the vote tomorrow. But, you know, this is a time where, you know, this country has a lot to deal with internally. We've got rising costs in too many areas, whether it be because self-inflicted through tariffs or through the big ugly law that was passed last year or other things. But we should be dealing with our issues domestically. This was something that was really, I think, more at the direction of Israel than the United States, and how we could be, you know, entering into something because of that. Is still a big question that was unanswered. There's far more questions than answers at this point, I think, for most members of Congress.
Are you hearing more than the public is about the possibility of actual American troops within the borders of Iran at some point?
They were somewhat evasive on the answer to that again, which again is unsatisfactory and unacceptable. So no, I don't think I have much more information than the average person does on that.
Representative Mark Pocan is with us, Democrat from South Central Wisconsin, looking at the U.S. and Israeli attack on Iran. We've heard concerns that a lot of Americans and others are stuck in airports or hotels around the Middle East, their travel plans interrupted, State Department saying, hey, get out, not clear how people are supposed to get out. Is that something you're hearing at all from your own constituents?
Literally, Everett, 15 minutes ago, I was on the phone with someone in Dubai trying to help two people that I know from the district are there. There's 30 Americans at the hotel, I guess, that they're at, and trying to figure this out. You know, they did lead the briefing with this that we can work through the State Department to try to help. The problem is, I guess, there's some airspace issues. But the person I just talked to said there's flights coming in and out of countries like Russia and other countries right now, depending where you are in the Middle East. Not quite sure if we understand this flight space question, but, you know, if they're not prioritizing the American citizens, then they're not doing their jobs. And right now, I'm not sure they're doing their jobs.
You've suggested on social media that these attacks are a way for the president to divert attention from other issues. What issues are you referring to?
Well, you know, clearly cost of living, you know, what he's doing to the economy right now, he's in the tank in the polls, and we're seeing that in election after election. And the Epstein files, which for whatever reason, they are protecting whoever's in the files to the point that they're not releasing them as required by law passed by in a bipartisan way by every single person in Congress but one person. So, you know, I don't understand much of how the Trump administration is operating other than they have a lot of problems right now. Whenever you go to war, it's a nice way to try to shift it. But in this case, public opinion isn't going with them because they have not made an adequate case. And if you haven't made an adequate case, you can't just go, you know, if you're supposed to be the guy wanting a Nobel Peace Prize and you start a board of peace and this is the eighth country you've bombed in a year, there's a disconnect. And the American people are smart enough to see that disconnect. So I think he's trying to cover from right now a failed presidency.
What do you want to see from the White House now in Iran?
What I want to see is honest answers. I want to see real dialogue with Congress. I want to make sure they're being honest with the American people about what's going on, none of which I feel are happening right now. But if we're going to put American men and women's lives at risk who are serving this country and people who are still abroad, we should really have the right answers given to us. And, you know, someone actually asked the question, just give us respect in your answers, you know, at the briefing, because they're not even doing that. They at times laughed at members of Congress. It's just this smug, you know, words I can't use on the public radio without getting you and I in trouble behavior that the administration has between Secretary Hegseth and Secretary Rubio and other administration officials. To call this a cluster, the rest of it would be an insult to clusters.
On a wider note, there have been concerns about increasing presidential power before the Trump administration, especially when it comes to war issues. Now, concerns over the White House having impoundments, not using congressionally mandated funding for various things. Are you worried about a wider balance of power issue when it comes to the separation of powers between the Congress, your legislative branch, and the executive branch, the presidency?
Absolutely, Rob. I mean, we're a co-equal branch of government, and we're acting like we're a subservient subsidiary of Trump Inc. Because Mike Johnson is the worst speaker I've seen in my adult lifetime. He won't stand up to the president, but we have the power of the purse, and yet the president's stealing funds that we approved in a bipartisan way. We've got the president issuing tariffs that can only be done in emergency situations. It's the power of Congress, and we're not standing up to the president as he's making everyone in the country pay more for goods. And now he's taking us into wars, our eighth country bombed without the advice and consent of Congress, which is required by law. This guy is acting like an authoritarian or a wannabe king. And unfortunately, the Republican leadership in the House is letting him. So, absolutely worried that we're hurting this country, really, fundamentally by not standing up for us as an institution in Congress.
Representative Pocan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rob.
That was Representative Mark Pocan, a Democrat from South Central Wisconsin. He joined us with his response to the U.S. and Israeli attack on Iran. If you have a personal connection with the events in Iran, if you've lived there or grew up there, if you have family members deployed with the U.S. military in the Middle East, or other personal ties, tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Again, that's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, a bill requiring insurance companies to cover extra breast cancer screenings is headed to the governor's desk. A breast surgeon says these scans are really important.
But many women cannot afford that diagnostic imaging if they need it. And so now that this law has passed, hopefully these exams become much more affordable and covered by insurance.
What's known as Gail's Law, that's next on WPR News. Now, in the final hours of its floor session last month, the State Assembly unanimously passed a bill requiring insurance companies to cover extra breast cancer screenings when a mammogram alone is not enough.
The bill called Gail's Law comes from years of advocacy by the family of Gail Ziemer from Nina, who died in 2024 after an 8-year battle with breast cancer that was detected late because of dense breast tissue. The legislation now heads to Governor Evers, who says he will sign it into law.
Here's the bill's co-author, Republican Representative Cindy Ducot, on the Assembly floor.
This is one of the most consequential votes we will ever take in this chamber. This bill is going to be signed into law, and this bill is going to save lives.
To learn more about the patients this law will impact and what it means for breast cancer screenings in the state, we're joined by Dr. Hope Guzzo, a breast surgeon at Amplify Health by Gunderson in La Crosse. Dr. Guzzo, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
As you hear that Gail's Law has passed the state assembly unanimously and is now all but certain to become law, what is your reaction to this development?
Yeah, I think it's incredible. There are so many women who have trouble paying for what some people would consider routine screening imaging and then subsequent diagnostic imaging. But many women cannot afford that diagnostic imaging if they need it. And so now that this law has passed, hopefully these exams become much more affordable and covered by insurance.
Can you talk further about the costs? If additional diagnostic scans aren't covered by insurance, what might that mean for patients who are paying out of pocket?
Yeah, I think it probably is different for every patient. We are really lucky here at Amplify Health, and we have a lot of grants available for patients. We do a lot of fundraising every year, and we have an amazing fundraiser called Steppin' Out in Pink, which raises millions of dollars. And so some of those funds we're able to use to have grants for women who can't afford their diagnostic imaging. But I don't think that's the case for every woman, obviously, in this state. And so I think, you know, it's probably different for everybody. And I know that there are some women who choose to not get that subsequent imaging because they do have to pay out of pocket and they can't afford it.
So once this is signed into law by Governor Evers, it will require insurance companies to cover additional screenings for breast cancer. Can you describe what are these additional screenings? What kind of tests or procedures would this entail?
Yeah, so I think there's kind of two arms that this is going to apply to. One is a woman who goes in for a screening mammogram, so has no complaints, just doing their yearly breast cancer screening, and then has a callback, which means they found an abnormality on their screening mammogram. So then they have to come back in for subsequent, what we call diagnostic imaging, which means further views on a mammogram and possibly an ultrasound. So that's kind of the first group of women, that women who have an abnormality, those subsequent images will be covered. Then the other group of women are women who are at increased risk, whether they are at high risk for breast cancer or potentially women who have dense breast tissue and are looking for additional imaging in addition to their mammograms. I think that this bill will also apply to those women who are looking for more imaging to be done in addition to their regular mammograms to help look for breast cancer.
How critical are these additional diagnostic scans, whether it's ultrasounds or MRIs, when it comes to detecting breast cancer or figuring out a treatment plan?
They're very critical. Any woman who has breast cancer comes through the clinic with a screening mammogram, and then they get diagnostic imaging where they get further views and then potentially an ultrasound and then a biopsy. And so those diagnostic imaging, that's how we define the abnormality, the mass, whatever it is on their mammogram. Calcifications, that could be how their cancer presented. And those diagnostic imaging are zoomed in pictures of those calcifications, and that's how we plan a biopsy. So that step is critical in the diagnosis of breast cancer. For women with dense breast tissue, we know that screening mammograms are less sensitive, sometimes at picking up cancers, because cancers can hide in the dense breast tissue. And so those women have the option to do supplemental imaging, and that is center dependent. Here at Amplify Health by Gunderson right now, we have a screening breast MRIs or abbreviated breast MRIs that women can do. Other centers in the state may have whole breast ultrasound or contrast enhanced mammography. And those are all added images that can help women with dense breast tissue get a better look at their breasts. I know that the woman who specifically is kind of in charge or behind Gail's Law, Gail Zener, kind of how this all started is she had dense breast tissue and her cancer might have had a delayed diagnosis because of that. And so I think hopefully now that this law is out there and passed, women who have dense breast tissue will be more enticing or feel more enticed to get additional imaging to look at their breasts.
We're talking with Dr. Hope Guzzo, a surgeon specializing in breast surgical oncology at Amplify Health by Gunderson in La Crosse. You mentioned Gail Zemer, the woman from Neenah, who was diagnosed with late-stage cancer that moved from her breast to her brain by the time it was detected. She passed away in 2024 at age 56. And Gail Zemer was instrumental in helping to pass a law in 2018 requiring that medical providers tell women if they have dense breast tissue. What are the diagnostic challenges when it comes to dense breast tissue, and how does that affect screening?
The way I describe it to patients is that dense breast tissue, kind of the fibroglandular milk-producing tissue of the breast, shows up white on mammogram, whereas fattier breast tissue, tissue that's not dense, shows up darker gray or more black-looking. And so you can imagine someone who has extremely dense breasts, when you get a screening mammogram and look at that mammogram, there's kind of white tissue all over. When women have breast cancers, many times those show up as something that appears more white. And so those can hide in kind of that white, denser tissue. And so I think that's where these subsequent images are extremely helpful. For example, screening breast MRIs. We use these routinely in our high-risk patient population. You know, we're trying to expand this and let more women know who have dense breast tissue that this is also an option for them. So that MRIs are the most sensitive image we have of the breast, and so it can look through that dense breast tissue a little bit better than a mammogram can sometimes.
How common is dense breast tissue among patients?
It's very common. About half of women have dense breasts. There's kind of four categories of density that is reported on every screening mammogram. So class A, B, C, and D. And any woman who has C or D density breasts is considered to have dense breasts. And that ends up being roughly half of women.
What are the options for women with dense breast tissue or who are at higher risk of developing breast cancer? What should they know?
It all depends, I think, on where a woman lives and the medical, you know, options that she has. Mm. There are various options for women to get supplemental screening who have dense breast tissue. Those options range from whole breast ultrasound to breast MRI, contrast enhanced mammography, and then molecular breast imaging. And then what a center has available is just dependent on where they are and what they have. So here at Amplify Health by Gunderson, currently we have breast MRI available and abbreviated breast MRI. Soon we will have contrast enhanced mammography. We do not currently do whole breast ultrasound for screening purposes or molecular breast imaging. But again, many other centers in the state may do those things. So I think it's just up to a woman to ask their providers what image options they have. If someone is considered high risk, meaning they have a calculated lifetime risk greater than 20% of developing breast cancer, they have a genetic mutation, they have a history of thoracic radiation, those women, it's in the guidelines that they are screened with breast MRI. That is kind of the standard of care in addition to mammogram.
And it used to be that women were recommended to start getting screened for breast cancer at age 50, and then a couple years back, that recommendation went down to age 40. What is behind that lowering of the age?
I think we're seeing increased rates of breast cancer in young women all the time. And so I think, you know, the American College of Radiology and American Society of Breast Surgeons has recommended the age of 40 for a while. But now we've kind of gotten all the groups on board with lowering that age to 40 and doing yearly screening. That would be the standard recommendation now.
Hmm. Do you think Will Gale's law change your practice at all in La Crosse? What impact could it have locally around the state?
Yeah, I think it absolutely will. I think dense breast tissue is a really hot topic right now, and we're hearing a lot about it. And that has a lot to do with the notifications that women have to receive. As you mentioned, in the state of Wisconsin, that's been around since 2018. But nationally, that was mandated in 2024, that everyone who has dense breast tissue has to be notified. Mm-hmm. And so I think now that we have Gale's law passed, we have the ability to recommend these images and hope that insurance is going to cover them. Whereas I think prior to this, a lot of times these are going to be out of pocket costs to a woman because insurance may not cover them. And so I'm hoping that, you know, this will change our practice and we'll have many more women seeking supplemental imaging who want it.
What is your advice of encouragement to women who may be at the age bracket to get a mammogram, but have been putting it off for one reason or another? What would you say?
I think it's really hard, and I think there's a lot of fear behind it. And so I do my best to just encourage women to listen to their body and also not to be afraid. I think education is super important. I think raising awareness, letting them know that breast cancer rates are increasing in young women and breast cancer can affect anybody. Many times there's no symptoms. And so I think if you wait until you feel a lump or wait until you have nipple discharge, wait until you see a change on an exam, sometimes that can be too late. We diagnose the vast majority of breast cancers on screening imaging in a woman that has no symptoms. And if we catch it earlier, we have a much better chance of curing that breast cancer and letting you live a long, healthy life with no recurrence of your cancer. And so if we can catch you on a screening image, that is the preferred way to catch a breast cancer if we can.
Has screen imaging technology improved? Have you seen it change and evolve?
Yeah, absolutely. I think 3D mammography is pretty much standard of care for most women when they go in for a screening mammogram now. And that didn't used to be the case. And we're exploring in the world we live in now the use of AI to help with things. And so I think mammography has come a long way and it's very good. I think sometimes I don't want people to take away that screening mammography is bad for women with dense breast tissue. It's still very good. At a minimum, if you can do anything, a screening mammogram is definitely the way to go. Nothing ever will replace a mammogram. I think that's the other thing people wonder is, well, should I just get an MRI or should I just do these supplemental options? But those don't replace the mammogram. The mammogram is still vitally important, and these are all added on in addition to that.
Dr. Guzzo, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you again so much for having me.
That is Dr. Hope Guzzo, a breast surgeon at Amplify Health by Gunderson in La Crosse. We've been talking about the impact of a bill, it's called Gale's Law, that will require insurance companies to cover additional breast cancer screenings beyond standard mammograms. And for disclosure, Amplify Health is a business sponsor of WPR.
Coming up, Phelps in northern Wisconsin has a lot of maple syrup producers. We'll find out why they're the maple syrup capital of Wisconsin and get new ideas on what to do with all that syrup.
I prefer a Wisconsin old-fashioned with pure maple syrup as the base for this drink.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Generations of Wisconsin families have adopted the Native American technique of tapping trees for sap and boiling it into a sugary syrup. Syrup has a special role in rural communities around the state who hold annual spring festivals to celebrate it.
Wisconsin produces more than 500,000 gallons of maple syrup every year, making it the third largest producer in the country. That's according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
In the northern part of the state, the town of Phelps bills itself as the maple syrup capital of Wisconsin, and the annual Phelps Maple Syrup Festival will be held on April 11th this year at the Phelps School. John Jackal owns What of You Farm and Weaver in Phelps with his wife Mary, where they produce maple syrup, honey, and weaving products. And Laura Richard is director of the Phelps Chamber of Commerce, which organizes the annual Phelps Maple Syrup Festival. Laura, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And John, thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
John, let's start with you. I understand you've been producing maple syrup for a couple decades now at your farm in Vilas County. What led you into producing maple syrup?
Well, it was just by chance, really. My wife and I moved here in 78. I was working in the woods with a small logging company. And in those days, when spring came, the road limits went on and most loggers just stopped working because they couldn't haul wood. So my boss said when he was younger, they made maple syrup in the spring because there was nothing else to do. And I thought it would sound like a good idea. So that's how I got into it.
Wow. And it seems like a process to me, right? From the sap to the syrup that I buy at the store. What goes into the production of that maple syrup once you've tapped that sap?
Well, it's really basically pretty simple. Like you said, you tap the trees in the spring of the year when the nights are below freezing, the days are above freezing, and the sap runs into your collection container. You take it and you boil it, because the sap is probably 97% or better water, and you want the sugar. So you boil it, and you boil out all this water to get down to syrup. And when it gets to be the right consistency, you bottle it, and it's maple syrup. So it's basically very simple.
Laura, Phelps is the maple syrup capital of Wisconsin, and therefore I say of the world. How did you get that designation for Phelps as the maple syrup capital of Wisconsin?
It is, yeah. So we claim that title after this fest kind of took off over the years. So that's kind of the origination of that, really. And just because there are a lot of, as John is one of them, a lot of producers around here, hobby, small backyard producers to bigger productions.
And tell us about the Maple Syrup Festival celebrating that status as the capital.
Yeah. So this is the 15th year of the fest. And it started, it's funny that John said he started producing just by chance. Maybe the fest started that way too. It started as, before my time here, with the group who started it, just looking to add something to bring people to town and something to do around here in like kind of the shoulder season or the off season. And so they were looking at this time of the year and what were people doing around here this time of the year? Well, a lot of people were producing maple syrup fest. So it turned into, let's have a maple syrup fest. And, you know, there is also like, you know, cranberry fest in Eagle River in the fall. So this is, you know, sort of that in the spring for what's going on in agriculture around here right now. So yeah, the fest is, it's on Saturday, April 11th this year. So it's typically in early April every year in Phelps, and it brings, we've had, I mean, definitely thousands of people that have come to town for this. Kind of the heart and the part of the fest is really the Sugarbush Tours, which John's location is a part of at his farm. So you can come and pick up the locations of the tours, and we have a few local producers who will come show you their all their equipment and their sugar shacks and their trees tapped and how they do it. And you can see the sap boiling and they'll talk about all that and you can really learn a lot about it. So it is really an agritourism event, which is cool. So it's very educational. And then the fest headquarters is at Phelps School. And there we have all kinds of things going on. It's super busy all day long. Some of the most popular parts of the fest headquarters are breakfast. We have a big breakfast that's put on by Sunrise Lodge with all maple syrup waffles and crepes and all kinds of treats and maple baked goods. So there's always a big line for that. And then there's a big craft fair. So you can, you know, shop all your unique vendors around here that come for that. And then there's also several like maple syrup related demonstrations and presentations. This year we have a few cooking with maple syrup demonstrations, cooking demos where you can sit and watch things being made with maple syrup. And it's amazing the things people come up with. You know, we've had like a dill maple dip that everyone's snacking on with pretzels that the crowd gets to taste and share. And you think of all breakfast stuff, but there's so many different things. So that's always interesting. And then we have hands-on demonstrations too. We do in the outside of the school, there's a hands-on tree tapping. So they have like the old school crank drill into the tree that everyone can try as they wish and hammer the tap in and you can start seeing the sugar water flow out and you can taste it if you want to. So that's always interesting. And then we do maple taffy on the snow where just for fun for a treat, you can like freeze maple syrup right on snow and just roll it up with like a popsicle stick and it's, you know, tastes like candy, like taffy.
And John, I hear sometimes, oh, with the weather, we're tapping earlier or later this year. What does weather from year to year mean for the quality and the quantity that you're able to produce?
The time that the sap starts to run varies every year. This year, it's actually starting a little later. It's really not late, but it's starting later than last year. So the season itself generally lasts about 30 days. Whether it starts early or late, it usually runs about 30 days before you have to quit. So the timing, when it starts and when it ends, doesn't affect the quality a whole lot, except for that if it's a late start and a late end, by the end of the season, the sap is getting warm and you have to process it right away or it loses quality, you end up with a darker, stronger flavored syrup.
Laura, what does the Phelps Maple Syrup Festival mean for the community?
It's really just become a big community festival. People from not just the immediate area and the community, but the region and the state and all over come for this. So it really has become a great tourism event for our area. So it's great for the local economy. And we get a lot of participation from community groups that come do booths and lots of people donate to raffles and lots of people volunteer. So that's all super helpful. And some of the things that bring people from out of the area in for this are not just the craft fair for vendors and people that come for that part of it, but also something that's become bigger and bigger over the years is the maple syrup judging competition. Mm-hmm. We've had over 50 producers that have entered this in the past couple of years. And so you can enter your syrup if you're a producer, big, small, any size, whether you tap five trees or 5,000. We have major companies that enter this and like small backyard producers. It's a great way to learn about your syrup, whether you're going to win or not, or you just want to learn your density, your clarity, see how your flavor stacks up. It's really interesting. So that goes on all day. And that's a lot of producers from all over the area come just to enter and bring their syrup and sit there and watch that all day and learn about it and hear the judging and hear the tasting comments and all that. So It really has like brought a lot to our community of all these people who've never been here before that come and they get to see Phelps and see the North Woods and enjoy our area.
All right, I want to close by asking each of you your favorite way to consume maple syrup. I'm going to start, though, and I say consume, not eat, because my favorite thing is I do cocktails and mocktails with maple syrup, citrus, maybe bitters. If it's a cocktail, then some bourbon or rye usually. John, let's start with you. Your favorite way to eat the maple syrup you produce.
Well, having said what you just said, I prefer a Wisconsin old-fashioned with What Have You Farm pure maple syrup as the base for this drink. You know, we use brandy here in Wisconsin, so that's the way that is. It's a brandy old fashioned, and the sweet is the maple syrup. But other than that, maple syrup on oatmeal in the morning is always a good thing, and you can't overlook pancakes and waffles just smothered in maple syrup.
Sure. All right, and Laura, your favorites.
I love maple syrup in coffee or on ice cream, both. If you haven't tried either, I highly recommend.
I've done ice cream. I haven't done coffee.
Yeah, it's good as a coffee sweetener. Yep.
Thank you so much, Laura, for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having us.
And John, thanks a lot for being with us.
You're welcome. I'm glad. I hope I can give you some good information.
John Jackal is the owner of What Have You Farm in Phelps, and Laura Richard is the director of the Phelps Chamber of Commerce, which organizes the annual Phelps Maple Syrup Festival. Syrup's being tapped right now, as I understand it. That Maple Syrup Festival is scheduled this year on April 11th. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Rochelle Wilson, and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.